listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
We've done an incredible job with Syria. When I took over Syria, it was infested with ISIS. It was all over the place. And now you have very little ISIS, and you have the caliphate almost knocked out.
That was President Donald Trump in a Face the Nation interview, which aired Super Bowl Sunday and was recorded the prior Friday, February 1st. The president had been asked about a disagreement between himself and some of his top intelligence advisors, particularly over his plans to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria and, ultimately, Afghanistan.
I think we've done a great job with that. At the same time, at a certain point, we want to bring our people back home. If you look at Afghanistan, we're going in very soon. We'll be going into our 19th year, spending $50 billion a year. Now, if you go back and look at any of my campaign speeches or rallies, I talked about it all the time.
You did.
Look, we're protecting the world. We're spending more money than anybody's ever spent in history by a lot. We spent, over the last 5 years, close to $50 billion a year in Afghanistan. That's more than most countries spend for everything, including education, medical, and everything else.
Is there a scenario where you would keep troops in Afghanistan, a smaller number? I mean,
yes, and I'll leave intelligence there, real intelligence, by the way. I'll leave intelligence there, and if I see nests forming, I'll do something about it. But for us to be spending $51 billion, like last year, or if you average the cost, you're talking about numbers that nobody's ever heard of before.
The Senate Republicans voted, vast majority of them said that they don't support what you're doing, that what you're doing risks national intelligence by a precipitous withdrawal from Syria and Afghanistan. Doesn't that concern you?
I ran against 17 Republicans. This was a big part of what I was saying, and I won very easily. I think the people out in the world, I think people in our country agree. We've been fighting for 19 years. Somebody said you're precipitously bringing to... Precipitously, we've been there for 19 years.
During the conversation, President Trump said that he did not need to keep troops in Syria in order to keep an eye on events in the Middle East, in particular on Iran. He made this reference to the massive U.S. military base that's been built in Iraq during the past three presidential administrations.
We spent a fortune on building this incredible base. We might as well keep it. And one of the reasons I want to keep it is because I want to be looking a little bit at Iran, because Iran is a real problem.
Whoa, that's news. You're keeping troops in Iraq because you want to be able to strike in Iran?
No, because I want to be able to watch Iran. All I want to do is be able to watch. We have an unbelievable and expensive military base built in Iraq. It's perfectly situated for looking at all over different parts of the troubled Middle East. Mm-hmm. Rather than pulling up, and this is what a lot of people don't understand, we're going to keep watching and we're going to keep seeing. And if there's trouble, if somebody's looking to do nuclear weapons or other things, we're going to know it before they do.
So you're going to trust the intelligence that you receive?
I am going to trust the intelligence that I'm putting there.
The president's comments drew some very angry responses from across the political spectrum in Iraq, but not from everyone there. This is former Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi. He spoke with RT's Sophie Shevardnadze about President Trump's comments and about the present relationship between Iraq and the U.S.
Well, this is very, very unfortunate, because there is an understanding and agreement that the existence of foreign troops, including U.S. forces here in Iraq, is to help Iraqi government fight terrorism. It's not a job of foreign troops to spy on our neighbors or use Iraq as springboard against our neighbors. This is not allowed in our constitution, Iraqi constitution, and this is not part of the whole of this operation. The number of U.S. troops in Iraq are limited. They don't have free movement in Iraq. They have to move with the consent of the Iraqi government. They don't have barracks for their own. They don't control the sky. Any flight in Iraq or outside Iraq should be by the agreement of the Iraqi government. So I think the whole thing is outside the scope of the relationship between the two countries. This is very unfortunate.
Can Iraqi forces maintain security on their own if Baghdad shows America the door?
Well, Iraqis gave a lot of sacrifices to fight Daesh. The people who fought on the ground are only Iraqis. Yes, we receive support. We receive support from our allies, from international coalition, and from the rest of our friends in terms of logistics, in terms of training, and in terms of providing some air cover to support our forces. But in actual fact, the only forces who are fighting on the ground are Iraqis. Yes, we can sustain this on our own, but I think this is not right. Terrorism is an international phenomenon, and Daesh is an international terrorist organization who not only have threatened Iraq, but threatened the region and the whole world. So it is right for the countries to cooperate to face this enemy and to quash them. And I think we have to work together. So yes, we have to work with the others in order to get rid of this terrorist organization altogether.
So the head of a Shia militia group said that the Iraq has capabilities to expel U.S. troops if needed. Are the Iraqi militias fired up enough to actually come to blows with the U.S. forces in the country?
Well, according to the Iraqi constitution, there is no place for militias in the country. By militias, I mean armed groups who are outside the control of the state. This is against the state, against the Iraqi people, and should not be allowed. We didn't allow it, and we will not allow it. If there are rogue elements who are acting outside the state, they will be the enemies of Iraq. They should not be allowed inside Iraq. As opposed to the other armed groups who are within the state. We have the army, we have the police, we have the public mobilization force, who have been now organized by the law, which is legislated by parliament, which is applicable now to the public mobilization force, who are within the framework of the Iraqi security apparatus, and they they are answerable to the commander-in-chief and to the rest of the security apparatus. If you ask me, do we allow rogue elements or elements who are outside the control of the state to act in Iraq? No, we shouldn't. This is outside the Iraqi, against the Iraqi constitution, against the will of the people, and is not allowed in Iraq.
So the calls for the U.S. withdrawal were also sparked by the fact that during his surprise visit in late December, President Trump didn't bother to meet any Iraqi officials. Is this insult something that could have long-term repercussions for U.S.-Iraqi ties?
Well, again, I think it is, I mean, if, according to Mr. Trump, this is his will. He wanted to visit his troops during Christmas time. This is his own decision. On the other side, the Iraqi government gave permission to Mr. Trump to visit his troops in the Ain al-Assad barrack in Western Al-Anbar. In my opinion, this was not organized properly. I think from day one, it should be have been organized in a way for officials, Iraqi government officials, to meet the president of the U.S. when he comes to Iraq. And the meeting could have been done in Baghdad. But I think it may be mismanagement which has led to this. This was unnecessary at all. It has poisoned the relationship slightly. But I hope we should move forward and forget about it.
So at the same time, during the crucial stages of the war against ISIS, United States air power came to Iraq's aid, and the coalition helped Iraq retake Mosul. Do you think that it's a bit ungrateful from the Iraqi politicians to be blaming the Americans now and bragging about Iraqi independence? I mean, when everyone was so happy to receive help in its time of crisis, nobody wanted them out back then.
Well, I think, I mean, this is the habit of politicians in every country. I mean, they look at the day-to-day running of the country, and of course they want to attract support from their constituents. I think at the time it's true that our allies, they stood with us to fight our enemy, the terrorist. But it doesn't mean that you give a blank check to whoever has helped us. Yes, we have to be grateful for those who stood with us. But at the same time, Iraqi sovereignty is very important. And the war is over. If there is no need for the troops to stay in Iraq, then there is no need. But if there is a need, we should think it over. We should discuss it in our parliament, with the government, with our political blocs, and we should decide what is the best for Iraq. At the end of the day, what we are going to apply is what is the best for Iraq, and we don't have any hostility to those who helped us to get rid of Daesh at all.
Turkey has bases in northern Iraq set up during the fight against ISIS, from which it fights the Kurds. Now, we hear Iraqi politicians protesting America's presence loud and clear, but they're not so vocal about the Turkish bases. Where's that cry from the Shia militias about that? I mean, is the Iraqi rhetoric condemning Americans just an attempt to look tough and anti-US for voters, maybe?
Well, I think it has become like a war of proxies. You know, there is hostility between the US and Iran. And it's a matter of proxies here in Iraq, where every side is using their proxies in their fight against each other. Yes, I agree. There are few Turkish military bases. They date some of them. They date back to the time or the days of Saddam Hussein when he was in power in the 80s, during the Iran-Iraq War and later on. And of course, we should not accept any military existence of foreign forces without the consent of the Iraqi government. I think, in my opinion, I agree with you. We must be partial on this. It shouldn't be double standard. But after all, we are part of this region, and the disagreement between states, especially between Iran and the United States, it has its impact on us. My call on my colleagues in the political establishment here in Iraq is we should confine our interests for the Iraqi people and sovereignty of Iraq. We should not be part of any proxy towards this or that.
So back in 2017, you announced victory over ISIS in Iraq. But ISIS attacks still happen every day in the country, and the group still holds a chunk of desert in the northwest. Was your optimism, shall we say, a little premature? How long is it before ISIS is rooted out completely, if that's ever possible?
Yes, if you go back to 2017, I was very careful. I said we crushed Daesh militarily. We liberated all our land. Daesh doesn't hold any territory inside Iraq, and they don't. What they're holding some territory in eastern or northeastern Syria, which is bordering Iraq, which is very dangerous, because if they are given a chance, they can go back to terrorism. At the moment, the extreme of Daesh, the danger of Daesh, is that they're trying to wage some terrorist attacks against the civilians inside Iraq City. They haven't succeeded yet. We quashed them. We strengthened our intelligence at the time. There is a fear that Daesh is concentrating on another campaign of terrorist attacks against civilians. And I hope our military and our security and intelligence are up to it. They were up to it. And if they should carry on with dismantling this very dangerous terrorist organization. This is not only against Iraq, it's against the whole region, against the world, if they are given a chance. So we should stay focused until we eliminate this terrorist organization altogether.
So the United States has a relationship with Iraq, and neighboring Iran has a relationship with Iraq, but United States and Iran are rivals. Can Iraq maneuver between these two centers of power and keep it its own independent agenda intact, or will it have to choose sooner or later?
Well, I think our choice is clear. We happen to have the longest border with our neighbor Iran. The U.S. doesn't happen to have a border with the Iran. I'm sure if they had, they would have thought differently how to deal with Iran, how to treat Iran. When you are a neighbor to another state, you have to look at your interests and the common interest between the two nations. We cannot move away from our neighbor. They cannot move away from us. So there's a huge interest. There's history. There's trade. There are a lot of amalgamating interests between our two nations and our two states. We have to safeguard our own interests. We shouldn't be party to this disagreement and this polarization of relationship. It's got nothing to do with us, to be honest with you. This is a nuclear agreement between the 5+1 members of the world community and Iran, and the U.S. decided to walk out of it. And why should we be a party to this? And we should be concentrating on our interests. Our relationship with Iran is very important for us. Our relationship with the U.S. is very important for us. We can achieve a common interest between the two. And we should be very much focused on this, not to allow any party to drag us along the wrong direction.
That was the former Prime Minister of Iraq, Haider al-Abadi, speaking with RT's Sophie Shevardnadze on a recent edition of her program, Sophie and Co.
Tonight, we renew our resolve that America will never be a socialist country.
That was President Trump during his State of the Union address last week. For more on that, we go to this segment from this week's Black Agenda Report, where Professor Anthony Montero speaks with Senior Editor Glenn Ford.
The speech itself was a demonstration of cheap political campaign rhetoric. And therefore, I don't see anything in it that one who is interested seriously in the direction of human history would take very seriously. On the one side, I saw his attack upon socialism, an attempt to define the Democratic Party, which is a joke, his claim, as a left-wing socialist party. Anybody that knows anything could not take that seriously. Even the so-called socialists in the Democratic Party, I don't consider socialist. Now, on the other side, if he is saying, which maybe he is, that there'll never be another New Deal kind of restructuring or reforming of capitalism, maybe that can be taken seriously and that can be debated. But even on that score, he stands on very, very thin ice, because another great recession, which would be greater than the last 2008 Great Recession, would, in all likelihood, as most commentators are suggesting, morph into something that looks like a Great Depression. And to save not just capitalism, but to save the rule of the ruling class itself would require reforms of a New Deal type. So it's not to be taken seriously. I am not yet prepared to even take what are called socialists seriously as socialists. Now, we can talk a little bit more about that. But I just think the whole discussion of Trump attacking socialists and socialists saying, look, we must be very powerful since Trump attacked us, I think is just a performance on all sides.
Well, certainly a national single-payer health care system is not socialist, or it does not mean that we have a socialist system. After all, most of the rest of the industrial world already has such a system.
Right. And most of the non-industrial world or the developing economies, such as China and Vietnam and North Korea, and probably South Korea, have that. I should also mention Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. So the United States, in terms of caring for its people and it being the responsibility ultimately of the state to care for vital needs of the people, we are an outvalue. Most people and nations in the world have accepted a form of capitalism, which also recognizes that to have political and social stability, you have to provide something for the people, and you have to regulate the inherent tendencies of capitalism to produce wide inequalities. Our economic model is perhaps unique in the world in regards to not being concerned about that. And a capitalism, as Martin Luther King said, socialism for the rich and rugged individualism for the working class and poor. So we're out of touch with the trajectory of history and with humanity, which I should say, by the way, Glenn, because we do not provide those things at the level of the government, because we have this ruthless form of capitalism, it makes our nation more ripe for rebellion and even revolutionary change than would be the case in nations that provide those things, such as Sweden, such even as England or France.
Well, in terms of being out of touch, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party seem to be out of touch with the base voters. 70% and more of Americans as a whole support this slew of proposals made by Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez. We're talking about single payer, but also free college tuition, Ocasio-Cortez's proposal to raise tax rates on the rich to 70%, and of course that Green New Deal proposal, the outlines of which have been revealed already, and which call for a total overhaul of the U.S. economy, not just its industrial parts.
Yeah, the fact that they do it from within the Democratic Party, to me, indicates that these are talking points and they will be talked to death, and that they're not serious in terms of creating the political conditions among the great mass of people. As you say, 70 and 80% of Democrats in particular support a kind of Green New Deal and universal health care without the insurance companies. But the fact that these proposals are made from within the Democratic Party and not from the standpoint of a mass movement suggests to me that they are not serious in terms of being implemented and are, in the end, talking points for the 2020 election and soon after that to be dropped and forgotten. So I hope you would forgive me for my skepticism. I am not cynical. I'm skeptical of a group of socialists who would prefer, rather than building a socialist movement with a program to overhaul the system are making proposals that look to be leaning in the direction of socialism from within a party that is dominated and controlled by, and in fact exists for the sake of keeping the 1% or the 1/10 of 1% or the corporate imperialists in power.
You seem to be predicting that the Democratic Party will accept these proposals that have super majorities and only dump them after the election, but accept them at convention. Many of us think that this Democratic Party will not allow these proposals to get to the convention, and that this rejection by the party of these super majority backed proposals could lead to an explosion of the party and a huge defection of disgruntled leftish Democrats.
Well, this is what we're faced with. And, you know, to put it in really stark terms, the Democratic Party, like the Republican Party, face crises that are existential. These parties, for the majority of people, are no longer seen as legitimate and useful in the conduct of the people's business, in the pursuant of people's democratic aspirations, be they for health care, be they for a green economy or whatever. So, I think the Democratic Party is fighting a struggle to regain some legitimacy or to regain legitimacy as they go into the 2020 election. I don't think that these proposals are serious unless they are based upon building a movement in the industrial states, in these big cities, among the poor. I can think, as I always am thinking, about Philadelphia. Where are the mechanisms to build support for a green economy, for universal health care, and on and on and on? So that's my point. I don't think it's serious. I think the Democrats are trying to build a coalition for 2020. I think they face a real problem at their convention because as long as they flirt with left, and I put quotes around that, of their party and have to concede some things, at least in terms of talking points, it does suggest that there will be people who will take it seriously. And when they get to that convention and find out that, well, we could talk about these issues, but that's as far as it's going, then you might have an explosion on the floor of the Democratic Party convention. Something like you had in 2016 when they had to make the Sanders delegates invisible.
Of course, you're correct about movement politics, and we know where movement politics go during election years. And now we seem to be having a two-year election year. That is, the 2020 election year has already begun.
No question. And, you know, there's a historical precedent of sorts in the 1968 Democratic Party convention. Right now, I have to say, I don't take this left wing of the Democratic Party, including the DSA, serious. I think they want to talk issues to death, but they do not want to build the types of movements to make these talking points into policy. The other thing is, I don't consider it left unless, along with domestic proposals for reform, there is talk of cutting these huge military budgets and ending the U.S. war policies throughout the world.
And in fact, the Democratic Party went along with the Trump budget, which was even bigger than what Trump had asked for the military-industrial complex.
Absolutely, including Bernie Sanders, the most well-known socialist in the United States. So we're at the beginning of something, the end of something, and the beginning of something. I think we have to assess what is going on more clearly. I think included in any discussion of 2020 has to be the crisis of the U.S. dollar, which in many ways explains this Bolton Pompeo Trump coup d'etat or attempted coup d'etat in Venezuela. I think the response of China and Russia and Turkey and Iran to it has to do in large measure with this new aggressiveness with respect to, first of all, a multipolar world and a world that is no longer dominated by the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency. In that sense, if the U.S. dollar retreats or is forced to retreat, that means the cost of the U.S. military empire increases, which means in order to pay for the military empire, greater austerity at home. So you cannot detach the call for universal health care, getting rid of the insurance companies, a green economy, and on and on and on, without at the same time recognizing that the conditions that would have made that possible and the assumptions that you would have to have made to make that possible, let us say 20 or 30 years ago, and that assumption was that the dollar had a privileged place in the world, which means you could have both a military empire and presumably a welfare state at home. I think those assumptions have to be thrown to the side. I think what might be driving more of this and the crisis could be the rise of multiple currencies, including the petrol yuan and other currencies, even the euro under certain conditions that challenge the dollar, which then makes the U.S. military empire too expensive to continue. In that kind of circumstance, a real left would have to be in place or arise to explain the conditions that the American working people and poor and middle class face and the path forward.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Iran has just marked its 40th anniversary since the Islamic Revolution. This is quite an achievement, one that comes with admiration for many, but to the dismay of some, like the U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton. He has said that Iran would not see its 40th year in power. In this edition of The Debate, we will look at the U.S. anti-Iran policies, which has spanned for decades, and how the U.S. has miscalculated Iran throughout all this time.
Iranians hold nationwide rallies to mark the 40th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The demonstrators pledged allegiance to the ideals of the Islamic Revolution while condemning the U.S. and Israel for plotting against their country. They also said the Iranian nation will not buckle down under the U.S. pressure and sanctions.
I've learned to fight for our land, for Iran. I've learned not to capitulate to the U.S. ever. May God have such a mercy on us to be grateful of the revolution and its blessing. We will defend this revolution and its ideals to our last breath.
Hailing the mass participation of people in the rallies, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said the turnout shows that enemies have failed in their plots against the Iranian nation.
This year, we are celebrating the anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, while the criminal U.S., the Zionists, and the regional reactionaries have intensified the pressure of sanctions on our people through their conspiracies. So today, the presence of people on the streets across the nation means that the years-long plots of the enemies have been foiled. This turnout also shows that the enemies will never achieve their evil objectives.
Rouhani noted that Iran will boost its military power and missile capabilities despite mounting pressure from hostile countries. It's been 40 years since the Iranian nation succeeded in bringing down the regime of the Shah, who was a staunch ally of the U.S. Since then, Washington has been doing whatever possible to harm the Iranian government and nation. In 2017, John Bolton, who is currently U.S. National Security Advisor, said, "What many of us in the United States are working toward is that the Ayatollah Khomeini's 1979 revolution will not last until its 40th birthday." He made the comments in Paris at a gathering of the MKO, a terrorist organization responsible for the killing of thousands of Iranians. U.S. officials have adopted an extremely hostile policy toward Iran under the Trump administration, with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo pledging to starve Iranians until they give in to Washington's demands. The Islamic Republic, however, has managed to withstand all the pressure and maintain its independence thanks to its people's unflinching support.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, former American intelligence linguist Scott Rickert, joins us from Tampa. And we have editor at Veterans Today, Mike Harris, who joins us from Phoenix. Gentlemen, welcome. Let me start with you, Scott Rickert. We're looking at Iran marking its 40th year since the Islamic Revolution. And at this point, obviously, it was a great day in the way that Iranians turned out to show not only their admiration for the revolution, which many had their parents actually fight for, but it's interesting to see some of the reactions coming. The reaction coming from the U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton is that Iran's Islamic Revolution meant four decades of failure. Do you agree with him?
Well, absolutely not. Obviously, when you look at the success of Iran over the past 40 years, it's been tremendous. You look at the growth of the economy despite tremendous sanctions. Look at the growth of the industries. The industries have become far more advanced than anyone else in the region, considering the decimated economy when the Shah was basically pushed out, rightfully so. And also comparatively to what's happened, let's say, in Venezuela, with only 20 years ongoing sanctions, and the seriousness of the black market and corruption that we see in that country, unfortunately, that's caused one of the most devastating economic failures in the history of the world. And then also the other one to compare to is North Korea, that's also been under sanctions for 60 years, the longest standing sanctions in modern times. So I would say it's a magnificent success. The success that's gone on in Iran has just been tremendous. The ties that they have in the region obviously have shown to be very peaceful and very useful to the sovereignty of their neighbors and certainly their allies. So I would say, unfortunately, the U.S. has a tremendously biased opinion and also has created a tremendous propaganda network. I mean, just recently they've promoted a Fox News correspondent to be the head of propaganda for the State Department, working for Pompeo, a CIA propagandist. So, you know, we don't get the truth in the United States, and certainly I don't expect anything other than the falsehoods coming out of John Bolton's mouth.
Well, Mike Harris, you know, it's hard to obviously sum up four decades of Iran's revolution to have prevailed in the way, form, and manner that it did. But I'm curious as to the obviously animosity that exists between Iran and the U.S. I mean, they clash on many many ideological issues, but many say it's because Iran doesn't yield to the U.S. to become a puppet state for the U.S. What does that mean exactly?
Well, first, let me congratulate the Iranian people on the anniversary of their Independence Day. This is indeed something we're celebrating, and congratulations to every Iranian. But your commentary here that the animosity between the USA and Iran is really unfounded. The U.S. did have the Shah installed there. That happened back in 1953 when they overthrew and deposed the duly elected prime minister and really upset the democratic process in Iran. So we've got these 40 years later, and the animosity is still there. What the U.S. government and U.S. institutions need to realize is that Iran is a prime market for the U.S., and we should all be interested in transactional business here and commerce. That's really what it's all about. And so I'm surprised with President Trump that he is sticking with the neocon line that's been in place now since 1979, that the new management of Iran is bad and we have to depose them, instead of trying to find a way to benefit the American people and the Iranian people. Now, one thing that's really key to note here, Iran has withstood these sanctions for 40 years. The net effect of this has been to make Iran a stronger and more independent country. They're not interdependent like the rest of the global economy is. They've had to develop key industries to sustain their own people and to sustain their government. And that makes Iran stronger in the long term. And I congratulate them on that as well.
So how much longer do you think that this is going to go on, Scott Rickard? I know it's a bit of speculation here, but it's been 40 years, and of course everybody is aware by now what John Bolton said, and I hate to just keep quoting him, but his statements are prime for noting it here. And he said, the marking of the Islamic Revolution's anniversary in the U.S. carries special significance after he said that the Ayatollah Khomeini's 1979 revolution will not last until his 40th birthday. Obviously, he must be very dismayed, but is the U.S. and the path that is gone, which is met with failure, why doesn't the U.S., learn from its lessons and maybe try a different strategy?
Well, the U.S. has had the same strategy, obviously, for the last century. During their relationships with their allies, the French and the British, per se, from the beginning of the early 1900s, and certainly continuing that relationship with British allies, they've adopted a British foreign policy. And the British foreign policy has been incredibly aggressive over the last five centuries, looking at the way that they've manipulated not only Iran since the 1800s. I mean, Reuters acquired all the resources in Iran in the 1800s, stealing from the Iranian people way before any of the minds and thoughts that go between anybody's mind here in the United States and elsewhere in the world. So there is a history of the Iranian people being unfortunately abused by Western powers. And these Western powers have been dominating the world for over 500 years. So I really don't see an end to it because of the nature in which the world operates. The banking infrastructure that backs these governments are the drivers of these interventionism type of events. We see it clearly in Venezuela today with the work that the banking infrastructure has done there and the massive amounts of investment that they have in the oil industry in Venezuela and out of the United States alone. So I think one of the things that protects Iran from failing and makes it a succeeder in this case is the fact that they've maintained autonomy of their industries. At the same time, they've also kept their distance from allies in that sense. So there is a great amount of trust between the Iranian people, I believe, and their government, and I think that's rightfully so. I would hope that the Iranian people would see the fact that their government has been tremendously manipulated for so long and get behind whatever government they can find that will hold them sovereign. I like the comments that came out of Rouhani today, said that he would actually open the media and open dialogue because he really wants to have people, you know, find a discussion and speak their mind and learn the truth, so that people can speak more intelligently and understand when they're actually being propagandized from external sources.
The closest that I can see, I may be wrong, Mike Harris, of the U.S. Telling Iran of what it was a list of demands that was made by Mike Pompeo months ago, that if Iran was to meet these demands, then, you know, there's going to be a way for I guess for the two countries to start some kind of relationship. And of course, that was met by stiff resistance from Iran. You say that you're surprised that the Trump administration has not approached Iran on the economic side of things. What do you think is preventing Trump from going after Iran in that respect?
Well, what I think preventing it is the vested interest of the powers that be. There is a large school of thought here, the neocon school, that looks at Iran as the next target. This plain and simple, they're the next country that they want to impose regime change on. But Iran has an opportunity here. In last week, Iran suggested to the world that you make the entire Middle East a nuclear-free zone. And that is a win-win for everybody. The U.S. should be willing to support that. The U.S. will keep their nukes out, Israel will disarm or at least declare what they've got in their inventory, and that Iran will do the same, that people come clean, that you don't want to live in a nuclear-proliferated region. It's not good for anybody's health. That would be a good start, and from there you can take it into the economic discussions. There's lots of U.S. technology, there's lots of U.S. Commercial interests that would do well in Iran, and you know, it would serve the American people. It would give us more customers, more consumers out there, particularly on everything from jet engines to washers and dryers and stoves. You know, there's just a huge market that is going unaddressed by the United States. And Iran has something the U.S. wants. They've got the fourth largest known reserves of oil in the world. And let's do business. Let's do commerce. Let's be friends. Let's don't fight with each other. There's no upside in that. Everybody loses.
Well, that sounds like one approach, Scott Rickard. What do you think? I mean, do you think that's something that could work when it comes to Iran?
Well, maybe at Disneyland. Unfortunately, that's not the way the United States operates. Unfortunately, the United States basically cuts deals and backs out. At the same time, you see a tremendous amount of betrayal on the United States part. Look what they did with the JCPOA. Now look what they've done to Assad when they had Assad give up his chemical weapons. They continue the fight over and over again. There's no benefit in cutting a deal with the United States. Now, from a supply side economic perspective, absolutely. It would be great if the United States would stop manipulating the market, stop devaluing the Iranian currency, and continue a fair trade policy and do supply side economics. That the Iranian economy would boom. You would see one of the fastest growing economies on Earth. Unfortunately, the United States would not like to see that. The United States is very threatened by booming economies because the United States suffers from $150 trillion in commercial debt and $20 trillion in governmental debt. We are the most in-debt nation in the history of the world, and our economy is always teetering on failure. We have to borrow $1 trillion every year. So obviously, having booming economies and providing a fair trade environment with countries that can easily beat our economy is not something that the United States administrations, no matter if it's Democratic or Republican, will be even allowed to do. The banks will not allow it.
One of the major I don't want to call it sticking points because it goes, further beyond that, is the Israeli factor there, William, Mike Harris. I mean, one of the key things that Iran has is its support for Palestinians and their rights. And, of course, that obviously concerns or puts Israel into the equation. And it's a major difference that Iran has with the U.S. That is something that will not be ironed out, nor will Iran stop its support for Palestinians. How much of a factor does that play when it comes to the relationship of Iran and the U.S.?
Well, it's enormous, and it reflects on the influence that Israel has over U.S. foreign policy. It's a direct indicator there because Israel is scared to death that if they lose the support of the United States, Israel will cease to be in about 3 days. They'll be gone because everybody's afraid to push on Israel too hard because of the U.S. Obligation to it. But as far as an ally goes, the U.S. also has to do the calculus here. What has Israel done for the U.S.? And, you know, I've been watching this thing my entire life. I mean, I've not seen anything that Israel has ever done for the U.S. in return. They give us a little intelligence we could have gotten anyway, big deal. They've done nothing, and there is a school of thought within the defense and intelligence communities that Israel has become a liability and not an asset. And that school of thought needs to spread, and it is spreading. But that really is the key sticking point. And back to what Mr. Rickard said, you know, I am a bit of an idealist. I'm really hoping that the U.S. can break their paradigm of thought. But he is correct in that the U.S. and banking interests in particular are scared to death of losing control. So they would rather try to dominate other countries than try to work with them commercially. Because if we're successful with Iran and how they structure themselves and the independence that they show, the U.S. is afraid that the rest of the U.S. empire, the colonies out there, will show independence as well and want to be treated in the same manner. And that's one of the main reasons why they don't want to Iran to succeed. It's imperative that they do not, because others may become upstarts and want the same freedoms.
You know, I'm listening there to Mike Harris, Scott Rickard, talk about how Israel, in the U.S., or a proportion in the U.S., are seeing it as a liability. That almost goes synonymous with another ally of the U.S. in the region, and that is Saudi Arabia. Of course, time will tell, but maybe the U.S. will see that when it takes a look at some of its so-called allies, that perhaps Iran could be more of a stabilizing factor, even though right now they're saying that Iran is a destabilizing factor in the region, something which Iran not only denies but is confused as to how it's viewed that way.
Well, there's nothing to be confused about. We use these terms, Israel and Saudi Arabia, allied ship, but let's talk about the real underlying issues here. This is a British Empire cooperative environment. These are quote-unquote allies that were formed out of the petroleum industry, out of the Zionist industry. This Zionist industry was very closely coupled with the financial infrastructure of the European banking infrastructure, has become incredibly embedded in the American religious and political and financial infrastructure. You don't have any one individual that's involved. You have over 70 million in the United States alone that are pro-Israel Zionists, and this goes everything from one of the highest banking environments, from J.P. Morgan, you have obviously Goldman Sachs, you have the Brookings on the left, you have the Cato Institute on the right. You have a tremendous amount of organization and structure that just goes beyond the imagination. It's unfathomable for most Americans to even understand the corruption that's going on. So to say that, you know, Saudi Arabia and these allied ships, these are absolutely business and banking relationships. They're geopolitical relationships that have gone back to the early 1900s and the founding of the oil industries in the United States. So I really don't believe that people really understand the structure in which they're dealing with. So I would say only just be aware that this has nothing to do with American creating freedom, democracy, or any of these things that they sell to the American people. This is a business, and this is a business that's run very brutally.
I'm going to give each of you 1 minute looking at the future relationship, Mike Harris, between Iran and the U.S. Under the U.S. President Donald Trump. What course of action will they take? They're having in the next couple of days this, they don't call it an anti-Iran summit anymore, or meeting in Warsaw, but they have all these actions that are aimed at just basically destabilizing Iran or to make Iran uncomfortable on top of the sanctions. Where do you see the future go between these two countries?
Well, it's going to depend on how Iran responds. And I would recommend that the Iranians reach out and invite Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to come for a state visit as a guest, and to sit him down and say, look, enough of this bickering and fighting back and forth. We understand you have your interest. We also have ours. How can we compromise to the benefit of all? Because going to war and doing what General Wesley Clark said a number of years ago about toppling seven countries in 5 years is nonsense. And Donald Trump has committed to no more foreign wars, no more foreign entanglements. So starting war is not going to be beneficial and supportive with his policy. It's a good time now to use that leverage that Iran has, take advantage of Trump being in office and saying, look, we want to talk, and get Pompeo over here so we can cut a deal of some kind. I don't know what it's going to look like, but that is the approach. Go with dialogue, be optimistic, because Iran has a lot to offer to the U.S.
Go ahead with that same question, Scott Rickert.
Well, certainly it would be nice if that would happen. Unfortunately, what you're seeing with the work that the United States is doing alongside the MKO and other organizations, anybody that they can work with, and the embedded nature of expats from the Shah's days that are not only within the American intelligence environment, they also operate in the American education system. I don't believe you'll see any of those types of things happen. I think you'll continually see the current status quo, I should say, for the attempt to overthrow and undermine the current government. The U.S. has been doing that over and over again. They've done it since the Rose Revolution with Saakashvili. They're doing it right now with Guaido and in Venezuela. And that was actually started by the Democrats in around 2008, 2009. And certainly Donald Trump and his administration is just grasping it. And the Democrats under Pelosi are jumping right behind Trump in all of this interventionism in Venezuela. So sadly, I think, unfortunately, prepare yourself because the Americans are going to continue.
Thank you for that. Former American Intelligence Link with Scott Rickert. And thank you, Editor of Veterans Today, Mike Harris. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Recovery Thought, my entire team in the capital, Tehran, is goodbye.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.